You are now listening to the Project Kuwait.
To the Project Kuwait.
To the Project Kuwait.
Where we stop at nothing to bring you the right facts on health, fitness, and psychology. Featuring some of the world's most experienced professionals. So you can learn, lift, and live. With your hosts, Meg, Dr. D, and Mehdi.
After high school, I got into the pill scene and stuff. And from there, it was just... yeah, it was absolute chaos from there. I got into heroin for a little bit, and my life was just going in a bad direction. It was ugly. I found myself homeless in Lowell for a short period of time. And one morning, I just woke up on a park bench and realized I had nobody to call. I had nothing to my name. I smelled like absolute dog shit. It was like 30 fights that night. So a lot of guys that were fighting. So you're sizing everybody up. And it's kind of funny because our whole group of friends was saying, oh, look at that guy. He looks like Ivan Drago from Rocky IV.
Oh, man.
All this and more in today's episode.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Project. And in this episode, we are talking to Mark Costello. Literally, after the movie, A Cinderella Man, this guy is a total fucking Cinderella story. I grew up with Mark for many years. We had arguments, we had fights, we had laughs, we had tears together. We drove around in what we used to call the Molester Mobile, and we had a lot of fun. It was a big blue van, Meg, all right? We didn't do anything in there, but that's what everyone pegged it as.
It was not a big, good name.
I know, right? But it was this big, ugly ass.
Let's be clear, we called it that to mess with our buddy that owned it.
Okay. I was like, hold on, this took a dark turn. I'm out.
That was strictly just directed at the person that owned that van.
Okay.
Which was me. Was that me? but yeah, oh, Mark's a dear friend. And I mean, just Mark, from where you were, dude. So I mean, dude, just dive right into it. Talk about from the high school days, dude, from back when it all started, when you showed up in my basement, you know, at 3 o'clock in the morning one night.
Which parts do you want me to talk about? Which parts do you want me to leave out here, Maddie?
Well, you could talk about everything, dude. Anything and everything. I mean, you know.
We had good times, man. You know, yeah, maybe a little too good sometimes, but we're surviving. We're still here.
That's true. And
by the great God, right?
Yeah, our motto was, if it doesn't kill you, it just makes you stronger. That's what we always used to say, the three of us, me, you, and Davey Boy.
Yeah, look where that got us, huh?
How many of the things that you did could have potentially killed you, though?
Miracle was still here. Let's put it that way.
All right, so Mark, yeah, start off from where it all started, buddy.
Yeah, it all started off in your basement, Matty. You're to blame for all this.
Hey, man, at least you're throwing haymakers for cancer. I think that's the most important thing while we brought you on here. So,
ooh, yeah, that, you know what? I'm honored to be a part of this group, man. It's really cool. And the fact is it's the 10th year they've done this, so it's their 10th anniversary, and we're looking to break records here, money-wise. It's going pretty well so far. Our goal is about $850,000, and every penny earned goes straight to cancer research.
So yeah, explain a little bit of what that organization is, because I haven't heard of it, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are probably curious about that too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's starting to blow up. It's called Haymakers for Hope. This group of people, they go around to local gyms and have people sign up to fight in their first amateur fight. And we get a chance to raise as much money as we possibly can for cancer while we're doing it, while we're training, stuff like that. We get money from ticket sales, t-shirt sales, fundraising. People get to donate. It's just really, it's a really cool thing. And in this whole journey, we learn a cool little trick in the fight world.
Awesome. So like, you're just going specifically like boxing gyms? Is this like any other style of fighting, or what's
it's strictly boxing, and it's going to be held at the House of Blues in Boston.
Oh, that's awesome.
About 2,000 tickets, 2,500 tickets that get sold. So it's pretty wild to do your first fight, first amateur fight in front of that many people, you know, for such a good cause.
Yeah. So did you start this organization, or what's your involvement with it?
No, I just signed up through the gym. I had no idea about it, but then I signed up for a local gym with my nephew to get him into sports a little bit. Me and my wife just got custody of him and his brother. So we were kind of looking for a way to bond a little bit, and I took him down to this gym, and a few of the girls were training to do women's one.
Okay.
And we went to watch it there and I fell in love with it. You know, it's just a great cause and a great experience.
So is boxing something you grew up doing or how did you?
5 months ago, you know? So,
oh shit. That's awesome.
I'm telling you, I'm 36 years old and I'm just starting to, I'm in 5 months of boxing. I've already taken 6 fights.
Wow.
So, yeah. It's been a blast. It's quite the trip. Who would have thought?
Well, you got a hard head, Marky. All right. I've seen you put it through many walls, buddy.
My head's so, hard. But...
Was it the haymakers that kind of encouraged you to get into boxing in the first place, or you just wanted to start boxing and then stumbled upon haymakers while you were in the gym?
No, like I said, we had just recently, me and my wife, who I'm actually fighting for, got custody of our 2 nephews. And he had never really been into sports, the 14-year-old. And we wanted to introduce him to the sport world, you know, make some friends, stuff like that. So I took him down to the gym, the boxing gym, to see if he had an interest. And I wound up doing it with him.
God, that's so cool.
Yeah, yeah. It's right in West Roxbury, down the street from us, Boxsmith Boxing Gym. It's awesome. Great place.
And at 36 years old, to pick up a sport like boxing, what's that like?
Oh, my God. I've never been so sore in my life. I'll tell you.
That's awesome. I'm obsessed with the coordination, you know, piece that's required in boxing, just from the top of your body to the bottom, from your left to your right. I think that's absolutely incredible.
Who would have thought so much goes into throwing a punch?
Right.
It's insane. You know what it is? It's the conditioning that is, you learn that you're out of shape when you start boxing. I'll tell you. Holy smokes. I could have had a heart attack in my first week.
Well, I mean, Mark, don't sell yourself short. You were a hockey player. You know, you were a great hockey player when you were younger in high school.
Many moons ago, Maddie.
It was many moons ago, but you still have it. You still got the coordination there. So, you know, don't sell yourself short.
We're still standing. We're still doing it. So,
but how's the journey been, man? Like, how has it been? I mean, obviously, we wanted to bring you on this show to talk about the haymakers and, you know, the organization and everything that goes into it. But also, how's your journey been from a mental and a physical state to where it is now?
Yeah, absolutely. I could touch on that. I mean, Maddie, you know how deep it can go with me. I could take you to the end of the world and back here. You know well about me. After high school, I got into the pill scene and stuff. And from there, it was just, yeah, it was absolute chaos from there. I got into heroin for a little bit, and my life was just going in a bad direction. It was ugly. I found myself homeless in Lowell for a short period of time. And one morning, I just woke up on a park bench and realized I had nobody to call. I had nothing to my name. I smelled like absolute dog shit. I was at an all-time low, and luckily I found my way to the hospital and got the help I needed and bounced back big time. Now I'm a full-time carpenter. I got a beautiful family. I fell in love with my wife, Denise, a few years back, and we got custody of our 2 kids. It's been from an all-time low to an all-time high in a matter of no time, I'll tell you what. And then to throw this into the mix, it's just more motivation to keep doing the right thing.
I guess how long was that from the first time it started with pills until you waking up on that bench and kind of having that moment? I guess how long was that process?
I mean, it happens faster than you would like it to. I started doing pills probably when I was 20, just recreational, having fun with it out at parties. And then it started spiraling downhill, becoming more of a daily thing, probably around 22, 23. And I was one of those people that said, I'd never get into anything harder than doing pills. And I could stop whenever. And before you knew it, I had a needle in my arm. And this lasted for till I was about, God, I don't even know, 30 years old, probably.
10 years.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
wow, that's
a complete blur. I mean, you remember when it started, Maddie. You guys always tried to talk me down off that ledge, but there was just something about it that I fell in love with hardcore.
Did you ever, I guess, in the recovery process, is that something that they kind of have you work through? Is like, what was the appeal to it at that time? Or what were, you know, what were you trying to...
Were to it, why you know what I mean? You got to dig deep and really find out what caused you to keep repeating these behaviors and why did I keep going back to this? What can I change? Who can I change being around? I mean, you got to re-alter your entire life just to get this right. But it comes down to whether or not you want to have a good life or you want to, I mean, I was inevitably going to end up dead.
Right.
So it couldn't have gone on much longer anyways. I was either going to wind up in the ground in jail or get the help I needed.
Right.
Luckily, I found what I needed.
was gonna say, what pulled you out of that? So you went to the hospital, you say you kind of had that waking up and having that thought of, you know, it can't go much longer like this. And then that process of recovery, was it once you made that choice? I mean, I'm sure there were some struggles through that, or what are some of the biggest things you contributed towards you being able to continue in that process despite setbacks or, you know, anything?
Yeah, I'll tell you, that morning I woke up in Lowell, I'll never forget it, that feeling that just overcame me. I never had felt that before. I had been in and out of detox and rehabs, and always it was the same exact thing. I can beat this. I can do this. I can do this. And I never really got to that low point where I meant it until I woke up on that bench and just had nowhere to go, nobody to call. I missed everybody. I sat there like a little kid with no one to reach out to, as a grown man, just bawling my eyes out, realizing that this is it. Either I'm going to die or I'm going to get the help. And somehow I found the strength to walk myself to the hospital and tell them I needed to check myself in before I did something stupid.
Oh, that's amazing. I have chills just listening to you talk about it. Like
Yeah, it's crazy. But you know what? These are the things I got to keep up front and remember. I got to remember how I felt that morning I woke up and just had nobody, you know?
Right.
I mean, it still pokes me up thinking about it.
So from walking into the hospital that time after the bench, I guess, like, I'm just curious how the recovery process works. Like, how long do they keep you there? Or how long before, like, you're kind of just back at home and trying to do it on your own? Or what's the depth of a process for somebody who, like you said, you had no one to count on, you had nothing to your name. So I'm just curious, like, how does someone get help in that situation?
You just got to ask, man. There's people out there that are more than willing to help. I had a complete stranger just take me in that hospital, sit with me for hours and talk to me about what was going on. And they wouldn't leave my side until they got me to the detox that I needed to be, because they knew I was in a vulnerable state. And this guy, he was just a social worker that came in, and his job was to just sit with me and make sure that I didn't do anything to harm myself or anybody else around me or try to leave. And, you know, this guy could have easily been like, you know what, screw this, I'm out of here. But he just sat with me, he talked with me about life and how I can get everything back, and it was going to take time. And heartwarming to think about stuff like that.
Absolutely. Asking for help is a huge skill. I think a lot of people don't think of it as a skill, but it's pretty damn important. You know, it's
beautiful. And then I went to the detox. I was there for a few days. I moved into a program in Bournewood. It's called Bournewood. It was a sober house that I was allowed to live at, but I had to go to their day program and work their day program for a while. Learned some skills on coping and how to deal with it and what to do in certain situations. And it just gives you a chance to network and get your emotions in check after that detox, because that's really when the reality of what you did starts to set in. Because when you got a clear mind, you never think you would do the things you do when you're struggling, looking to get high, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's realization to you as a sober person of the things that you did while you were messed up is just, it can take its toll. So it's good to be monitored like that, where I had somewhere to go every single day until they thought, all right, we can graduate you from this program and you can go out on the working world. I stayed living in the sober house for a little bit, so I'm still around a good network of guys that were keeping an eye on me. Right. You know? And luckily, while I was in there, I met who I'm married to now, my beautiful wife, and she really straightened me out. She's a great woman, and she was big motivation for me.
That's amazing. She was there as, like, working, or was she going through a similar thing?
In the house, yeah. She had 10 years clean, and she was friends. So it was kind of through networking. Right. I met her through another addict that she was friends with helping in the house. That was cool.
So how was the bounce back, dude? I mean, after that, like, how was the climb back to the top to where you are right now, dude?
It's been surreal, man. I mean, I think about where I was and where I'm at now, and I don't have everything that somebody could possibly dream of, but what I have right now is unbelievable compared to where I was at. I never am a million years would have thought I'm where I'm at. Right. I'm married. I got custody of two amazing kids that are just bring so much joy to me and my wife. We got a rescued pit that we love with all our heart. We have a beautiful home, full-time jobs, food in our fridge. It's wild. I never thought I'd be here. I mean, you've seen some of my fridges, Maddie.
Cheese, milk, and beer. That was pretty much it.
I was just going to say getting back into, like, working, or that those, like, first interviews and things like that, I'm sure it was just a complete shift and change in pace and life and everything. And going into some of those first interviews, I guess, what did that feel like?
I'm sorry. What do you mean? Like job interviews and stuff?
Yeah. Like just like getting out of like finally feeling in a place where you have a little bit more control, like you said, over your emotions and things. And now getting into a place where you're networking maybe a little bit outside of who's in the sober house and, you know, looking to make a living and getting into work and to find something that you enjoy doing. I mean, it sounds like you have some passion for what you're doing for work right now.
Oh, absolutely. I'm very lucky. I'm a carpenter by trade, and I fell in love with doing what I do at a young age. My grandfather had a woodworking shop. My uncle was always a carpenter, and I always helped him working. So I kind of fell right back into that. I went to what I was comfortable with, but it was also what was a passion of mine. So I could put a lot of my energy towards what I enjoy doing. And that kept my idle hands busy, which was real good.
I can imagine there's a lot of, you know, society expectations of after bouncing off of something like that, of, you know, having a certain kind of job or just getting a job in general, it might not be something you enjoy. So the fact that you were able to recognize what you did enjoy and turn that into something that could provide a living for you, I think that's just a huge journey and process of its own. I think for a lot of people, they're stuck doing something that they don't like doing. And for someone coming off of an addiction, you know, that can often be a reason, I think, for probably relapsing.
Oh, absolutely. The stigma that comes with being an addict is just, it can be absolutely crippling. You can let it pick you, you can let it make you, you know, you can use it as a drive, or you can, like you said, let it cripple you and just settle for less.
Right.
You know, don't think you deserve better, but everybody, you get second, third chances in this world. You know, you got to take it and you got to run with it. Absolutely. But it can be absolutely tough. You feel like you're going for a job interview and you got heroin addict written across your forehead. This guy automatically knows. Those feelings are there, but you got to look to overcome those and start looking at yourself as a person and not an addict anymore.
Yeah.
Somebody that deserves a good life.
Right. Yeah, sure.
Wow, dude, that's deep, man. I mean, Marky, I'm sorry I wasn't there for you, brother. I mean, at this time I was in Kuwait, so
no, dude, I put myself in that position. That's what I had to realize, you know. For a while I blamed other people. Oh, nobody will reach out to me. Nobody wants to talk to me. Fuck it. I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing. But I was the one that wasn't reaching out. I wasn't asking for help. I was the one that was secluding myself from everybody. And I had to realize that and pick the blame up and run with it myself to get help.
So how long have you had custody of your kids now?
We've had them, hon. How long has it been? Well, it's been about 2 years now. It was a month after we got married, actually.
Oh, awesome. I guess, how open are you guys with this kind of stuff with your kids? And I guess, how does that play a part in parenting?
You know, it's stuff that we still deal with right now. They're still both very young. The 14-year-old, we're honest with him. And he knows any question he has, we'll answer. We'll be honest with him. We'll be truthful. I mean, yeah, it's what we did in the past, but it's not who we are now.
Right. And
As long as they realize that, know that their best interest is our biggest priority now, and that part of us is behind us, and they're number one in our hearts. That's what matters to us.
Absolutely.
And I think, well, you know, the 14-year-old, he grew up with it, with the addiction. That's how he wound up with us, you know. He's very familiar, very aware. And the last thing we would want to do is lie to him about it and hide anything from him. So, and it's good for him too, because he sees these two people that came from this world living the correct way. Maybe there's hope in his foreseeable future for other people that he cares about.
That's huge. That's huge. I think just being able to feel comfortable asking your parents questions that's just a huge achievement.
Absolutely.
You know, anyway, as a parent.
Smarter than I am too. So I can't dance around any questions with them.
Right. But that's something I need. I mean, I know Maddie is like in Kuwait, that's a huge thing. I think a lot of people there, because there is so much society pressure on image and things, it's anything like this that comes up, it's out of sight, out of mind, keep it hush hush, don't talk about it, try to, you know, just blindfold over the eyes, and then you just see the problem spiraling even worse. So
yeah, absolutely.
And in Massachusetts, I mean it's got one of the biggest heroin problems in the United States. I think, like, it's really bad in Massachusetts, right, Mark? I mean, you could probably
yeah, it's up. Yeah, man. It's a battle every day.
What do you think that, why Boston?
honestly, I think it's everywhere now, to tell you the truth. Right. I think when it first started out, it was a select few cities, but now it's affecting everybody everywhere. At first, it was just bad neighborhoods, and then it scaled into it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. They say from Yale to jail, you know?
Right, right.
Wow.
And everybody.
And that's important. You talk about the stigmas that are associated with that, and I think that's really important of like, this can affect anybody. Like we were just talking about, I hate to bring it up, but coronavirus and how people, you know, kind of feel like they're just invincible to it. And I think that society-wise, there's a certain status level that people think if they get to, they're kind of invincible from dealing with some dark things like this. And that's, it can affect anybody. And I think we all suffer from some level of an addiction to something, you know,
whether it be eating or gambling or whatever.
Right. Whatever you know? Your escape is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, Mark, what about the physical part? Because, I mean, obviously, if you're when you were probably down and out, you probably lost a lot of muscle. You probably lost a lot of body mass, too, dude.
It was bad, man. Like a little skeleton. A stiff wind could have blew me over.
Really, dude? Now, we're talking about a guy who was a big, burly guy when we were growing up. I mean, I've wrestled with Mark a few times and got my ass whooped by him plenty of times, but I did break his thumb. I did.
Maddie, I
remember that. You did break my thumb, you sicko.
Maddie, I think the summer when you go back to Boston, I think you should maybe do your first amateur fight.
Get him in the ring.
I think that would be awesome.
We'll do a live cast of it.
Oh, yes, please.
Dude, see, Meg, the thing is Mark knows I'm stupid enough that he says, Maddie, let's do it. I'd probably do it.
You'll
like
do it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he'll get it. We'll make this happen.
Yes.
Dude, I would not step in a ring with you, man. You still want revenge on me for snapping your thumb, buddy. I'm sorry.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it still hurts when it rains, I'll tell you.
I'm sorry.
Oh, shit.
No, mate, he had me in a bear hug, right? And I kept telling him, Mark, I'm a little guy. Like, I'm a lot smaller than Mark. Mark's like 6'1".
Scrappy.
He's 5'11", and he's like 260 pounds. And I'm like, Mark, let me go. Mark.
You just hit him 260 pounds?
You were, dude. You were a big boy, man. Like, you're a big guy, you know? Like back then, you were a big guy, you know? And he didn't want me
to... Yeah.
He had me in the bear hug and I just snapped his thumb, just ripped it back.
That's hilarious.
But, the funny thing is we were still hanging out like 20 minutes later. He wasn't even pissed.
Yeah. That's how boys kind of are though. You guys get over it quick. That's funny. So I guess, yeah, going back to Maddie's question, kind of like the health aspect and journey of it, like, are there things that still kind of linger, I guess, from the past experience of going through the, you know, the drugs and things that you were messing with? Or what's your lifestyle like now as far as like nutrition and fitness and those kinds of things? Or how was that?
It's night and day compared to how I was living. I mean, I was lucky to have a bag of Doritos a week back then,
right,
when I was getting messed up. Honestly, I've never felt so good in my life. I'm 36 years old and I'm in the best shape of my life now. I've gone from, I started boxing 5 months ago, I was 250 pounds. I'm down to 219 right now. I'm eating good, eating healthy, exercising every day, getting the rest I need, going to work. I mean, I feel great.
That's awesome.
You should check out his Facebook page, because that's what made me want to bring him on the show, is because the transformation that he went through body-wise and like mentally, you can see it in the videos, you can see it in the pictures. And I mean, Mark, I mean, dude, I tip my hat to you, man. Like, you've come a long way, brother. You've come a real long way. And what you're doing for such a good cause is amazing. And why boxing, dude?
Hey, why not, right?
Yeah.
It's a good time. Like I told you, I wanted to find a common ground that me and my nephew could do, you know, have something in common with and go do together. We walked in there and I figured it was just going to be some workout classes, hit the bags with the kid a little bit, throw some mitts. And next thing I knew, I was in my first fight a month later and I absolutely loved it. Yeah. Yeah. It's a good time. You take your licks and you get every now and then and you get to give a few. So good times.
So what's your training like right now? Like, how many times a week are you going? How many hours are you putting in at the gym? Do you have a full-time, like, do you have a coach that you answer to, that you work with? Or how does all that work right now for you?
Yeah, I got the best coach in the game, Maddie. Her name's Jess Smith. She runs Blocksmith out of West Roxbury. I'm going to throw the plug in right there.
Oh, go ahead, dude. Go ahead, man. I'll bring her on the show. If she wants to come on, I'll bring her on the show, dude. I'd love to have her on
the show. Great, man. And she, you know what? She runs such a good program and she's so involved with every single one of her fighters that it's just such on a very personal level that your finest trust in it. And that's, I think that's real important when you're boxing, because when you step in that ring, you step in there alone. So her job is huge to get you ready to that, be at that level. And she does an amazing job with that. But as far as training, yeah, I'm training every single day. I go Monday and Wednesdays to group classes. And then I do sparring later that night on Monday and Saturdays. I do a private class with her on Sundays. And then I'm at the gym on the opposite days, either doing cardio or strength and core training.
God, you've gone down the rabbit hole real quick.
Yeah. That a boy, Marky.
You got a new addiction.
Absolutely. Hey, this one's not as bad.
Right.
This one's a lot better, especially if they start rioting in the streets for Corona. At least you can protect yourself.
Yeah, right.
I'm a CrossFitter. All I can fucking do is wad.
Yeah, I got to get my toilet paper somehow, right?
But not thumb wrestling for it, apparently.
No thumb wrestling. You ruined that career quick.
God damn it, Maddie.
Sorry. I fucked up your thumb war, man.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm so excited to look up a boxing. It's something, like I said, it's something I've always wanted to get into, but I think just hearing that you're 36 and that's when you picked it up, it just totally gave me a big kick in the ass right now. Like, what the fuck are you waiting for? Just try
it. Get down there. You'd love it. I'm telling you right now. I even got my wife down there doing the workouts now. She doesn't do the fights. She just goes and does the classes. And she loves it, man.
That's awesome.
I got her down there. I got my nephew down there. It's a family sport.
I think that's so cool that you guys are all doing it together. More families need to find something like that they can bond over. That isn't
absolutely. It's a good bonding experience. Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing.
So what are the classes like? Is it more of like a box and burn type of class, or like what's the setup?
It's intense stuff, man. It's an hour straight of just working out. It's doing 20 burpees in a row and then hitting the heavy bags 200 times, dropping right down into some mountain climbers. And you're doing this for an hour straight. It's intense. Working the mitts with her. It all depends. Cause like, and I do my private classes with her and we're working on footwork and we're working on defense, but the group classes are more like cardio and getting your heart rate up for the whole hour.
So, amazing. What do you find the most helpful for recovery from intense workouts like that? I mean, cause you're in there every day doing shit. So what's been like
your... And you're a carpenter too.
Right. Yeah. You're a lot of physical work. That probably helps you a lot right there. It's just always moving. But what's the recovery process?
Yeah, the best thing you can do is just get the proper rest that you need. Don't overdo it. Amen. You know, because you get into this zone where you just want to keep going and going. But you got to know that even though you feel good right now, you may do damage for tomorrow. You got to know your limits, get plenty of rest, and your diet's important too. Mm-hmm. You're not going to get the same results out of your workout if you're not eating the right way or getting enough water in. Yeah. So every little factor plays such a big part when you're trying to do something this physical and this demanding.
Do you think that understanding your threshold on that of like physically when you need to rest and stuff, do you think you're a little more turned on to that just because of you pushing that threshold so hard previously?
Oh, absolutely. You learn the hard way, unfortunately. Right. Oh, you think you're getting in a little better workout than you have the rest of the days, but then you wake up the next day and you can't work out as hard because you overdid it. You know, you learn the hard way where to, all right, I pushed it enough. Now I can stop. I got to go get some rest, get some food in me, get some energy, and then I can start over tomorrow and push myself a little bit further.
It's awesome that you can recognize that. Same for myself. It took a massive muscle injury for me to, I think, recognize that point. And then it became a battle between the brain and the body of like having a really hard time getting back into it at all.
Right. Then, yeah. Know where you want to be, but right. You're not quite there. So you try to force yourself, I think, a little bit.
Yeah.
Just human nature, I think.
Yeah, definitely.
So, dude, real quick, because we touched on it a little bit about being 36 years old and getting into it. And you hit on an important point about footwork. Now, the coordination that it takes to box and the coordination in sports in general, dude, how's that been like getting into the footwork side of it? Like, I mean, say I'm in the same boat. I'm going to be 37 in May and I'm doing CrossFit, learning how to walk on my hands and shit and do bar muscle ups and stuff. So the coordination's tough. So how's it for you? Because it's the same as like hockey and baseball, that your feet do a lot, especially in boxing. So how's that been?
It's been interesting. It's definitely there, you know. when when I first started out boxing again, I thought my feet were just going to naturally come back, but it took a couple of weeks to get my feet back under me, but they do feel good. I think from being an athlete, it came back more natural. I mean, I'm not Muhammad Ali in there. I know that, you know.
Oh, come on.
I'm a far cry. But it definitely helps the being an athlete in a past life, you know, the muscle memory comes back a little bit. And I think that helps me move around there a little better than I normally would be able to had I not played hockey all those years.
Well, I mean, in general, dude, you were an all-out athlete when, you know, when we were younger, we'd go play basketball if we had nothing to do. I think that was the best part. It was basketball during the day and go have fun at night. You know, it was something like along those lines.
We were always something, weren't we?
I know, dude.
Sign of the times.
But even when we got into trouble, we always had a basketball in the car and we'd go to a school that was closed up and, you know, just shoot hoops till 3 o'clock in the morning. And that was a regular routine of ours.
Absolutely. It was. Yeah. We had a good time doing it, didn't we?
Yeah. Every night at Coolidge, man. Yeah, we go to Coolidge. We go to Lilja School over there. So Mark's been an athlete his whole life. But dude, now what goes through your mind when you step in the ring right now as a 36-year-old, you know, like your first bout, can you walk us through that of how that was? Did you have, like some people say, I was in there fighting for my life again? You know, I've heard that story of when they came from rock bottom to the top and they say, I was fighting for my life, or I was fighting for this, or I was having flashbacks. How was it for you, dude?
Yeah, that's all cool and shit, but I was just trying not to get knocked out.
Attaboy. Attaboy, Marky. I love you, buddy. No philosophy behind it. I love you, man.
That's all you can do is take what's right in front of you, though.
Yeah, what am I supposed to do? I'm in the corner. That bell rings. No matter what I'm thinking, he's going to come try and hit my head off.
Yeah.
You got to be ready at that point.
Did you know the guy you were fighting the first time, or is it a stranger?
No, I actually met him about 15 minutes before I fought him.
What's that like? I guess that whole, I mean, you see that with fighters, you know, there is a lot of good sportsmanship, I think, in the community. Obviously you take.
Yeah, he wound up being a great guy. It was funny though, because we had all noticed him walk around the gym. We're like, oh, I wonder who you're fighting. It was like 30 fights that night. So a lot of guys that were fighting. So you're sizing everybody up. And it's kind of funny because our whole group of friends was saying, oh, look at that guy. He looks like Ivan Drago from Rocky Fort.
Oh man.
Oh yeah, where this is going, don't you? In the back of my head saying, oh yeah, this is him. They were all calling him Ivan Drago from Rocky Fort. All of a sudden, yeah, this is the guy you're fighting. Sure as shit, you're fighting Ivan Drago. So yeah, I was looking across the ring at that monster. His legs were the size of a redwood.
And, man.
Yeah, hey, once that bell rings, all that goes out the window. I think we had a good fight against them. I think, and you learn from every fight. You get a little bit, the nerves settle a little bit every fight. Every time you step in that ring, you feel a little bit more comfortable, you know? Believe it or not, the more relaxed you are in a fight, the better you're off.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure.
You know, you see more. Mm-hmm. You're more aware.
That makes sense. So what are you doing for strength? You talked about your cardio. So what are you doing for strength and conditioning for boxing? I mean, obviously you still want to have muscle, but you still want to have quickness too. So
absolutely. You just kind of stick to a push-pull routine. You know what I'm talking about, Matt.
Yeah.
3 day gym was just pushing and pulling, 15 reps, everything, 3 sets, keep it light, but keep it fast. Good form. You want to work on your speed as well as your strength, but you don't want to be bulky in the ring.
Yeah, and I think
you got to put up high numbers, low weight, but it's hard work. You minimal rest in between sets.
Yeah. Maddie, have you ever done the CrossFit workout Fight Gone Bad?
No, I haven't done that one yet. I haven't done that one yet.
Oh, God, that's one. It like simulates, it's like, you know, 5 minute rounds and you get a minute break. So it simulates like the UFC style.
Oh, no, wait. I think I did Fight Gone Bad. I'm not sure. I don't know. I've done so many
of
them. It
was created by a fighter, but he basically, went through this workout. It's like a minute of each exercise and then you get a minute of rest and you go through that for 5 times. And they asked him like at the end how he felt. And he was like, it was like a fight gone bad.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, it's brutal.
I think I've done that one. I think Rob gave me that a few months ago.
Yeah.
But Mark, I mean, you brought up a good point, because a lot of athletes, especially boxers or, you know, baseball players, hockey players, sometimes will go to the heavy weights and they'll go through that slow motion and they'll get into that routine where, you know, I've heard from a lot of pros and a lot of, you know, pro coaches, you want to go quick if you want to develop those fast twitch muscle fibers versus that slow and controlled, which a bodybuilder usually does. Now, has your coach talked about that at all? Or, I mean, how's that? Like, is there any merit to that from your perspective when it comes to fighting? I mean, you've been in the weight room long enough, so.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, you want to work on those fast twitch muscles. You're doing lighter weight, but you're doing a lot more reps. You want to do a couple controlled ones, and then you want to crank a few out. Get that speed going. That way, those fast twitch muscles can react on a dime.
Yeah.
You know, and you're working on a lot of that in the gym with the heavy bag. You don't want to work so much on throwing your power with your jab, but the speed of your jab and that return of that jab for the double, triple jabs.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. You can also find us on Instagram at The Project Kuwait. Thank you, and join us next time.